I'm Carla Hills. I'm a trustee of CSIS, and I am delighted to be here joining you at the launch of this report, Meeting the Challenges and Opportunities of China's Rise, Expanding and Improving Interaction Between American and Chinese Policy Communities. And I'm joined here at the head table by Bates Gill, very talented author and expert on Chinese affairs. He holds the Freeman Chair in Chinese Studies here at CSIS. He has previously served as a senior fellow in the Foreign Policy Studies and the inaugural director for the Center of Northeast Asia Policy Studies at Brookings Institution. And his biography is at the back of the report. I can also say he's on the board of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations and contributes in a very substantial way. And to my right is Michael Green, who is an expert in East Asian studies. Michael has joined CSIS in December out of the National Security Advisor, where he was an Asian specialist, and we're delighted to have you join us. Michael also has been at Georgetown University, but he will comment on this report. And I've been asked to give some opening remarks. I feel strongly about the expansion and the level of interaction between the United States and China's policy communities. And as I define policy communities, I start with cabinet officers and go on to legislators, academics, think tanks, scholars on both sides of the Pacific, a broad policy community. So I congratulate Bates and CSIS for focusing on the need to encourage and to facilitate interaction between the United States and China's policy communities and outlining ways where we could more effectively accomplish that. I don't think it's widely appreciated how directly the national interests of China and the United States intersect on a broad range of policy issues, from energy to the environment, economics to education, nuclear threats, which really ought to be forefront in our minds this morning, and pandemic risks, and so much more. Our ability to deal successfully with most of these issues requires greater bilateral cooperation built on mutual trust, which, as Bates correctly notes in his report, can only be developed by, and I'm using his language, confident, regularized, and effective communications between the policy communities in Washington and in Beijing. The report ably documents that our economies have become mutually dependent in a very short period of time. In 1990, our commerce with China was minuscule. Today, China is America's third largest trading partner. It accounts for 1/8 of our total imports. It is our fastest growing export market. It grew at 160% over the past half decade, much, much more rapidly than our exports to the rest of the world. It is our second largest purchaser of treasury bills, and clearly a decline in the fortunes of one would adversely affect the fortunes of the other. And yet, to listen to some of the political rhetoric, you might believe just the opposite. And in my view, that is because there is a lack of understanding on both sides of the circumstances and the constraints facing the other. A large number of Americans see the growth of China as a looming danger, fearing job loss by reason of competition with Chinese products made with low-cost labor and sold on the world market at an undervalued currency, to China's successful use of its soft power to maneuver our strategic interests in Asia, Africa, and Latin America in a downward direction. And that anxiety was reflected in the strident rhetoric that accompanied the China tariff bill introduced last spring by Senators Schumer and Graham, which was fortunately pulled just 2 weeks ago. But at the same time, a large number of Chinese worry that the United States is seeking to retard China's growth, insisting that its government implement economic policies that are unfit for a country that is at the development stage. Concern is expressed about the proximity of American military at China's periphery, and there's apprehensive about what they perceive to be the proclivity of the United States to act unilaterally. So the need to enhance understanding of this complex, new, interconnected relationship is great, and in my view, it is now. But the report reliably points out that we have some big hurdles in our way. Efforts of the broad policy community to become more informed about China by engaging more effectively with their policy counterparts in China are hampered by a number of factors. First, China isn't located just around the corner. It takes hours of air travel, and there are no direct flights between Washington and Beijing. In addition, China has come up onto the international stage with great speed, and it takes time to become familiar with the new China, which is very different from the China that existed 15 years ago, that barely registered on our policy radar screens. And most Americans, in any event, start with very little knowledge of old China. They are not familiar with Chinese history, language, or culture. And as the report documents, citizens from the United States travel to China only about a third as often as citizens from the European Union. And we have seen only half as many students from the United States studying in China as European students. And as Representative Randy Forbes, head of the Congressional China Caucus, is quoted as saying, there is an enormous void in our knowledge of China which must be filled. We have few analysts who read or speak Chinese or fully understand its culture. And the report sets out, and I think it's extremely useful if you thumb through the report, inserts in the text, that identify seven groups, along with their membership, that Congress has established to try to get abreast of China issues. Most of these groups have been created in the last couple of years. Some are called caucuses. Some are called commissions. Some seek to fill the knowledge gap. Others have made up their minds. But the level of knowledge about China is quite limited. And the report quotes Congressman Kirk, a Republican, and Congressman Larson, a Democrat, who co-founded and co-chair the U.S.-China Working Group, as saying that the congressional discussion on China, this is their words, is unfocused and non-productive and suffers from a dearth of great China congressional leaders on the U.S.-China issues. Congressman Kirk has further said, in describing the knowledge of the respective legislative bodies, the Senate view, and I'm using his words, the Senate view toward China is at least multifaceted with some ups and downs, and the House view toward China is relentlessly negative and highly misinformed. And it's significant to note that direct exposure to China, even by a member who is highly critical, results in greater understanding. Bates has quoted Senator Graham, who upon returning from China earlier this year said, "While in China we learned many things we never knew before." And Senator Schumer said after the same trip, "I am now more optimistic that we can solve the problems than before I came to China. This visit has been a great eye-opener." And finally, it's not always easy for government officials to reach out to their counterparts. As the report points out, the structures of our two governments are quite different, and sometimes there is no obvious counterparty. For example, there is no the Chinese don't have a Department of Energy, and energy is a big issue today. China's central government is comprised of layers of vice premiers, state councilors, commissioner chairs, ministers, and dozens of administrative agencies, which require an understanding of knowing who is principally responsible for a given issue. And even on our side, it's not altogether clear who is leading on a key China issue. The White House, the Department of State, the cabinet officer. Recognizing the critical importance of bilateral relationship and the value of direct interface, over the past 5 years, the executive branch of our government has made an effort to initiate some top-level exchanges. Some meet on a regular basis, some more sporadically. In 2005, Secretary of State, Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick began a strategic dialogue with his counterpart, China's Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs, to discuss a broad range of issues from trade to human rights. That same year, then Secretary of Treasury John Snow put a financial attaché in Beijing. And the year prior, the Department of Justice opened an FBI office in Beijing. Currently, both the Departments of Commerce and Agriculture have posted representatives in China, and the United States Trade Representative has announced an intention to do just that. And last month, during his first visit to China as Secretary of Treasury, Hank Paulson, who traveled often to China during his many years at Goldman Sachs, launched, with the approval of the White House, a U.S. China strategic economic dialogue, which builds on the strategic dialogue that Undersecretary Zoellick began at State in 2005. And this dialogue is intended to meet at the highest level twice each year to focus on key economic challenges. And that will clarify channels for talking about economic issues and regularize the face-to-face meetings. The Secretary was very careful to say that existing bilateral dialogues, which tend to focus on bilateral problems, will continue, including the Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade, led by the U.S. Trade Representative, and the Joint Economic Committee, led by the Department of Treasury. But still, more needs to be done. As stated by the eight U.S. trade representatives who served in both Democratic and Republican administrations between 1971 and 2005, in a joint letter directed last month to the Acting Secretary of Transportation, urging approval of a direct air flight between Beijing and Washington, D.C., they stated, "We are convinced that the Sino-American relations can be significantly enhanced through increased and more regular personal visits by Washington-based leaders in both the public and private sector, cabinet officers, legislators, diplomats, academic, think tank and analysts, and business executives meeting with their Beijing counterparts. We know from experience," they said, "that face-to-face dialogue is critical to building trust and developing mutual understanding." Beyond Congress, the executive branch, what the Washington, D.C. area is home to a long list of respected think tanks, which are part of the broad policy community. Bates has listed these and described their expertise in his report. And studies by our scholars of the policy issues involving China help, very definitely help, fill the knowledge gap. And joint studies with Chinese scholars are extremely helpful in filling the knowledge gap and creating mutual understanding. And Washington, which is the fastest growing area in the country, has a vibrant business community. And business leaders, through their investment in China, have very definitely enhanced U.S. understanding. As documented in Figure 6 in the report, however, Washington, D.C. is one of the few major capitals in the world that does not enjoy direct flights capital to capital. That is from Washington, D.C. to Beijing. It is also the largest metropolitan region in America without nonstop service to China, which we believe is a detriment to a broader policy community. And so these are the issues that are before us, how to expand and how to improve and have interaction. Bates has will cover the recommendations, but my personal opinion is that the complications posed by distance, intensified by differences in language, government structure, and rapid change in China, require us to do everything we possibly can to develop the expertise and to build relationships across the broad policy spectrum to enable our two nations to work more effectively together. So, Bates, tell us how we should do that.
Thank you very much, Carla. Thanks to all of you for joining us this morning. I want to extend a special note of gratitude to Carla for her service in the government, as well as leading a number of non-governmental organizations, especially as chairwoman of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, and for her service also to CSIS as a member of our Board of Trustees. Thanks also to Mike Green for joining us this morning. Mike was centrally involved over the past 5 years in intensifying and overseeing, I think, a good deal of improvement in U.S.-China relations, beginning from a pretty rocky start, as you all might remember, on April 1st, 2001. I want to thank Mike for his service in government and seeing that happen, and thank him, too, for joining CSIS. It's great to work with you here, Mike. Let me extend also my gratitude to Melissa Murphy and a cast of several other research associates and assistants within the Freeman Chair who have been extremely helpful in getting this report to where it is today. The mandate of the Freeman Chair, as laid out in the agreement we reached with Buck Freeman in establishing this position 15 years ago or so, was to help improve American understanding of China and East Asia. He recognized a long, long time ago the importance of that endeavor. And so I think this report fits squarely within the broader mandate of the Freeman Chair. And I think you can see it in some ways as partnering or complementing some of the other work that we've tried to do, most specifically, most recently, work that we've been fortunate to do with the Institute of International Economics and principally with Nick Lardy and Fred Bergsten in the publication of our study, China the Balance Sheet, What the World Needs to Know Now, about the emerging superpower in this multi-year project, again, in an effort to try and ramp up understanding here in Washington and across the United States about this challenge which China poses to us, and to make sure that for better or for worse, we at least are as fully informed as we can possibly be about the opportunities and the challenges which this country does pose to us here in the United States. This study, which is before you, is something I've been wanting to do for quite a long time. I've been struck in the past, just the past 2 or 3 years, this quite remarkable intensification of relations between the United States and China in both the public and the private sectors. I've often said that 2005 seemed to be the year that America woke up to China. It seemed a little more than a year ago that you couldn't walk through any airport without seeing the headlines of every major news magazine screaming about the need to know more about China, China the emerging giant, China the emerging superpower, et cetera, et cetera. And it's reflected very clearly, I think, on Capitol Hill, as Carla noted, that in just the past year or two, the establishment of several new groups on Capitol Hill with the express intent of trying to learn more and be better informed about China. I think all of this is to the good. And if perhaps a China expert can say so belatedly, recognizing the importance of China to American interests, but better late than never. And now is an opportunity for all of us who are concerned about this relationship to make sure that as we ramp up our understanding of China, we do it in the most effective ways possible, consistent with U.S. interests. So this study, I think, is something I've wanted to do to at least document in detail this rather remarkable shift in the way that at least the policy community in Washington has so significantly ramped up its engagement with China, but to assess it somewhat critically and ask, intensification, yes, but to what end? Intensification, yes, but how effective are we in seeing that this more intense relationship with China is moving us in a direction that is consistent with U.S. interests and consistent with the long-range improvement in U.S.-China strategic relations over time. So that's basically the intention of getting this report out there. I can tell you, it does. I admit and acknowledge right up front that it does not do full justice, I don't think, to fully detailing and providing a full enough analysis of this broadening range of interactions that's taking place between our public and private sectors, especially in Washington, and counterparts in Beijing. There is a lot going on between our governments and between our private sectors. I've tried to, I guess, skip lightly to at least give some sense of just how much is going on, but I'm sure a lot more detailed work awaits about the various types of interactions that take place between our public and private sectors, especially in Washington, and our counterparts in Beijing. And in our conversation later today in the Q&A, I'd be very interested in having from you greater information and insights about the various types of interactions which are described in this report. I don't want to go into detail on all those things. It's there for you to have a look at. What I want to do is spend the remainder of my time spelling out the 12 principal recommendations which are laid out in this report. These recommendations are categorized into four major baskets, one sort of being executive or government branch action, secondly, congressional action, thirdly, action that can be taken within the non-governmental or private sector, and then fourthly, some specific actions that can facilitate, logistically speaking, facilitate improved interaction between the policy communities of Washington and Beijing. And let me just go through those very quickly. Some of these issues are already out there. They're on the table. There's even some legislation in play that tries to promote some of these recommendations. For example, the need for us to expand our embassy and consular presence in China. That means both within existing facilities to see greater expansion in terms of our expertise on a number of emergent transnational issues where the United States and China clearly have shared interests, but also to expand beyond what exists in China to create additional consular sites across the country. And I think this is consistent with what Secretary Rice has put forward as our transformational diplomatic effort. But I cite in this recommendation that these transnational issues where we do share so many common interests, where it would make sense to expand our expertise and presence in China within our embassies and our consular corps, such as on energy security, environmental protection, dealing with infectious disease, illicit trafficking in drugs, weapons, and people. And that in addition to working and expanding on those issue areas, we probably need to do a lot more to expand our commercial service in China, both at the embassy and within our consular posts, to help improve the ability of our businesses to succeed in China. Secondly, expansion of the executive branch and congressional staffing on China. This is probably a no-brainer, but I think we can argue that there's a great need both in our intelligence community as well as on Capitol Hill and within the executive branch to invest in improved China expertise. Third, I recommend the establishment of a formal bilateral interagency working-level mechanism which can plan and coordinate official-level U.S.-China exchanges. This is not an uncommon technique within our government for dealing with certain key allies, where there's an interagency process, often in collaboration with counterparts in the other capital, that basically sits down and plans out what the coming year or two is going to portend, both in terms of official visits and sort of the logistics of those matters between the leaders of each side, but also on important emergent issue areas. To my understanding, there is no formal mechanism of this kind in trying to deal with China. There surely ought to be, given the importance of China and U.S.-China relations going forward. I'd be interested in Michael Green's take on whether that's a feasible and practicable approach. Fourth, for the executive branch, I propose that we increase lower-level and short-term secondment of officials between the United States and China. This obviously raises some sensitivities, and we'd have to be very cautious about the extent and level of access that these secondments would allow. But we already have some secondment already taking place that I'm aware of, especially between the health agencies of our two countries. Americans work today in the Chinese CDC in Beijing. And, of course, there is a significant presence of Chinese scientists and medical personnel working within our NIH. We should consider expanding this kind of secondment opportunity into other areas, hopefully less sensitive ones that might include cooperation on the environment, on transportation, energy, commerce, justice, education, and labor. Fifthly, moving to congressional action. I think we should be encouraged, by and large, by the rapid uptick in congressional interest in China over the past year. Sometimes we may be dismayed that that interest is sometimes, as Congressman Kirk put it, relentlessly negative. But I think alongside of that, we've also seen, I think, a more judicious and careful attempt by many members of Congress to structure their thinking about China and to take more time, including increasing of their visits over to China. This is all for the good, and we should all do what we can to encourage it. There are already a number of important organizations in our country, like the Aspen Institute, the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, the U.S.-Asia Institute, and others, which are very active in trying to inform Congress and members of congressional staff about our relationship with China, and importantly, to get them over to China on a more regular and structured basis. There is, sixthly, today, a number of very interesting bills that have been introduced to Congress for potential passage, which address many of the questions we're talking about here. I'm aware of at least two important ones. One was introduced by Senator Lieberman, which is Senate Bill 1117, and another was introduced by Representative Mark Kirk, H.R. 5199. These bills have a lot of similarities. There are a number of differences across the two of them, but by and large, they intend to ramp up funding, especially for our embassies, for our consular activities, to incentivize our states, the 50 states of the United States, to incentivize their ability to improve exports from their states to China, significant new funding in Chinese language studies, and other similar activities which are so clearly of interest to the United States. These bills have been introduced but have not moved to the floor for passage. I think we should do what we can to see that those bills do see the light of day and that these kinds of investments are made. Seventh, talking about the non-governmental policy community, I make a number of suggestions here. Obviously, do what we can both from the public and private sectors to invest in the activities of our non-governmental academic and think tank sectors to improve our interactions with China, also to improve our expertise in terms of Chinese studies, Chinese language, training, etc., and that some of this effort be directed at some of the professional schools, graduate schools in the United States, such as in law, in medicine, in international policy, and in business. Eighth, I noted with interest at the recent China-Europe summit, which took place in Helsinki about a month ago. It was announced at that time that the Chinese government would establish a kind of scholarship fund, which over the course of the next, I think, 5 or 7 years, would educate hundreds of European bachelor and graduate level students to come to China for Chinese language and Chinese studies. I propose here that perhaps as we come up to the 30th anniversary of diplomatic relations between the United States and China in 2009, that China establish a similar fund as a means of significantly increasing the opportunities for American bachelor level and graduate level students to travel to China and undertake studies there, both in broad China issues, but especially on Chinese language in particular. I think I'm about eighth or ninth here. We all should do what we can within the think tank community here and the academic community here in Washington to expand the kinds of briefings and interactions that we can have on Capitol Hill related to China. Now, as I said, there are a lot of these activities ongoing now. I think a lot more can be done, and I think we should be thinking internally within our think tank community about how we can do a better job of structuring these and delivering more frequent, regularized, and informative information to Capitol Hill, especially to congressional staff. And then finally, within the non-governmental policy community, I think we're at an interesting moment in our relationship with China, where we can explore and expand innovative forms of U.S.-China partnerships. What do I mean by this? I mean, I think much of our relationship with China, because of the nature of the People's Republic, has centered upon official government-to-government exchange. China is changing in interesting ways, which I think will increasingly allow for what is being termed public-private partnerships with China. I think Chinese counterparts are increasingly open, even government counterparts are increasingly open to working and creating partnerships with business, American businesses, as well as with not-for-profit organizations from the United States. And there are a full range of these sorts of more innovative, let's call them private sector types of initiatives from our side, which can engage the Chinese side. And I list a bunch of them: sister city relations, exchanges between primary, secondary, post-secondary, and graduate level institutions, expanding the presence of U.S. philanthropic organizations in China, and other innovative approaches. Finally, the fourth major basket, which I raise here, concern improving the logistics of effective policy community exchange. It's been noted already by Carla, for example, the need to establish a direct air route between Washington and Beijing. Mike was just mentioning to me how valuable he finds, for example, the ability to fly from Washington to Tokyo and back in a very short period of time, but get a lot of work done. It is sadly the case that we can't do that yet between Washington and Beijing, and I think it would do much to help facilitate, not only from a logistical basis, but I think it has an important political signal that can be made by seeing that sort of connection established as well. And then finally, as a recommendation, I think we all can do a lot more to invest in new communications technologies. I mean, I'm thinking simplistically something as basic as, video conferencing, which I think in the absence of the ability to have a face-to-face physical contact with counterparts in China, we should be surely doing a lot more in the way of engaging in that way, through video conferencing or through the expanded use of technologies which would allow for real-time translation, for example, through through software communication. I'm not an expert on some of these technological fixes, but I suspect that there's a lot more that can be done to help facilitate the logistics of communication between our two sides. So that, in a nutshell, are my the 12 principal recommendations of this report. I'm very interested in hearing your comments on that. But before we do, I've asked Mike Green, who a person who's been very, very directly engaged in the work of improving and expanding U.S.-China relations, to comment on some of these things. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Good morning. I want to applaud Bates for putting this report together and cataloging with specific reference to institutional connections and mechanisms that have been established over the past 4 years. What I sensed was happening when I was on the NSC, but never saw written down in this way. And it not only describes some important changes in U.S.-China relations since 2001, but also clearly points to where we need to do more in the bilateral relationship. I came into the NSC in April 2001, right in the middle of the EP3 crisis. At the time, I was responsible for Japan and Korea, not China. But I remember seeing this, frankly, chaos all around me. Not because the U.S. side wasn't organized. The U.S. side was very well organized, and the connectivity between state, DOD, and NSC was very smooth and very high level. Problem was connecting with the Chinese side. President Zhang was not prepared to take phone calls on this. Some fairly rudimentary defense confidence building mechanisms that had been built during the Clinton administration didn't work. The Chinese side wasn't pushing the buttons in response to our efforts, so to speak. And it became very clear that there was a dangerous deficit in connectivity between the U.S. and Chinese governments. Frankly, it also became clear that there were some disconnects within the Chinese side, which I think have been tended to over the past 5 years, particularly between the leadership and the PLA. But from the beginning, that, in my experience, for President Bush, for President Zhang, and then President Hu, was a clear warning sign that we needed to have very good connections between the leadership, and that at a top-down level, there really had to be an effort to build bilateral trust, communication, and ways to work together. And over the next 5 years, and eventually I did take on responsibility for all of Asia, including China, there was really a quite remarkable expansion of cooperation and dialogue with China. The six-party talks are one example. At the beginning, the Chinese position in 2002 in October, when North Korea's uranium enrichment was exposed, their clandestine nuclear program, the Chinese position was, and I quote, "China does not associate itself with North Korea's nuclear weapons." But if you look at how U.S.-China dialogue and coordination on this issue has grown over the last 4 years, it's remarkable. Today, the Chinese ambassador in the U.N. is talking about sanctions. Ambassador Bolton is talking about the best dialogue and progress he's ever had with China on these kind of issues. North Korea has helped, to be sure, but I think that it also reflects a deliberate investment on both sides' parts to be working on these kinds of issues. In APEC, 2001, 2002, 2003, we bumped heads with China more than we cooperated. But over time, we started to work together on specific initiatives in APEC and to make real progress. There are other new initiatives. President Bush and President Hu announced an initiative on avian influenza in China last November. China, the U.S., Australia, Korea, Japan, and India are in this six-party energy forum at the cabinet level that has met in Australia and is going to be an annual meeting. And on nonproliferation, I think even the toughest nonproliferation hawks on the U.S. side will tell you that over the past few years, the nonproliferation community in Japan, in the foreign ministry and elsewhere, and the nonproliferation community in the U.S. are working together on very specific cases in a problem-solving way. So there's been real significant progress. The problems have also become harder, though, and there are more of them. North Korea's escalation has made that problem more difficult. And in my experience preparing the president's briefing books for meetings with his Chinese counterparts, I noticed over the 5 years I was there, a steady expansion in the last part of the briefing book, which was not the bilateral issues, but the rest of the world, Burma, Sudan, Iran, and so forth. So one of the things that I think this report is pointing to is the need to coordinate not just on these bilateral issues, but on how we deal with third country issues where we have some significant differences that we need to tend to and where China's influence is considerable. I agree with every recommendation in the report. I think it's right on target. I do want to make one comment about strategic context. This doesn't contradict the report. It just provides the background that I think is important. This is the right recipe for strengthening U.S.-China cooperation and exchange between the governments, the Congress, the policy communities. But we need to set it against the backdrop of our broader Asia strategy. We have to have in the United States an Asia strategy, and China needs to be a part of it. I played soccer, my brother and I, in fourth grade, and the hardest time our soccer coach had was convincing all of these 9 and 10-year-old boys not to all run after the ball and leave the rest of the field wide open. And he drilled it into our heads again and again to stay on our position and work as a team. And we have to be careful to maintain equally strong relationships and dialogue with Japan, with Australia, with the Republic of Korea. The U.S.-China bilateral relationship exists within a context. I personally think it would be a strategic mistake for us to think we could manage China through a bipolar condominium. I think we need to set the stage in Asia as well. They're not mutually contradictory, but the relationship we have with Japan, with Korea, with Australia, the investment we put into relationships that are now underinvested, like Indonesia, will all provide context that will be healthy and stabilizing for U.S.-China relations. And that's not the focus of this report, but I think it's important. And I would add to that Taiwan, because I think we did a reasonably good job over the last few years in the administration stabilizing the Taiwan factor in U.S.-China relations. One reason we did it, one way we did it was by strengthening dialogue with Taipei. There's got to be a channel with Taipei that's robust in order to keep that element in U.S.-China relations something that doesn't become a distracting factor or a negative factor. People have referred to Bob Zelick's dialogue, senior dialogue with Dai Bingguo, the vice minister, and to Secretary Paulson's strategic economic dialogue. And I think that is worth building on because, in my experience, these relationships, these partnerships, work best when there is a high-level champion in the U.S. government. Rich Armitage, when he was Deputy Secretary of State, played that role with Japan, and really his presence was critical to building up U.S.-Japan relations in the first part of this administration. Bob Zelick did not reinvent or redefine U.S.-China policy, but he brought it together at a high level and added a coherence and a stewardship in his senior dialogue with Dai Bingguo that was really critical. Secretary Paulson is now doing that on the economic side, and I think the definition of that is quite broad to include things like energy. My understanding is Nick Burns, the undersecretary, is now going to be setting up a security and political and strategic dimension to this, and that's good because you need these champions to get lower levels of the bureaucracy to unglue problems and break through and to order assistant secretaries or senior directors in the NSC who are working on the Middle East or Africa to sit down with their Chinese counterparts and invest the time to work these issues. That's absolutely critical. It's been mentioned, but I think it's the core of how to move forward. I think there are some structural issues or structural problems that will make these recommendations both challenging but also necessary. On the U.S. side, one problem we have is that the China account is so enormous and has so many players, it's very hard for anyone, the senior director for Asia, the assistant secretary of state for East Asia, to actually manage China policy. In my case, I could do it when the president met with Hu Jintao because it all flowed up through the NSC. Jim Kelly or Chris Hill could do it, you know, when certain things happened like the Rice meetings with her counterparts or Powell's meetings with his counterpart. But as a general day-to-day process, China policy is just enormous and very difficult to coordinate. We had various levels of coordination meetings in the U.S. government at the assistant secretary and senior director level. It was the policy coordinating committee. We had very, very few on China because the ones we had 60 people in the room, all at comparable levels. It's very hard to have a coherent strategy when you have that many actors, all of whom have a legitimate stake in the U.S.-China relationship. I think the suggestion in the report of establishing a bilateral mechanism is excellent. My corollary or additional recommendation would to keep it small. We have with Japan, with the ROK, formal mechanisms that are spelled out in our treaty relationships, and the numbers of participants have expanded so much that the principals involved have started having their own secret meetings away from the rest of the bureaucracy in the two countries to actually get something done. And these other meetings are sort of action-forcing events. I think what would be incredibly useful in the U.S.-China context would be to have a small group of people who are responsible on a day-to-day basis. You mentioned, I think, deputy assistant secretary level, who would be limited in numbers, maybe state, NSC, DOD, Treasury, comparable Chinese counterparts, USTR, especially USTR. First job in government for me was USTR. To go off and do a kind of bedaiha, to go off for 2 days and with no pressure and actually think through the agenda for the year and report directly up to their principals. We've done that with Japan in the past. We've done it with Korea. It's been episodic, and it was very effective. And I think institutionalizing that is a good idea. The only risk with institutionalization is everybody wants in, so maybe you need to keep it informal. I am glad the report spent a page and a half on DOD. I will tell you frankly that that from my perspective and many of my colleagues in the NSC, the Pentagon was always behind in this relationship, was resistant, was able to do that because the PLA was equally resistant. I think that is very much now an underinvested part of this relationship. If we had another EP3 incident, I think the president and his counterpart and so forth would be in very good shape. But the military-to-military relationship has not matured enough, in my view, that we could handle an EP3 incident that much better if it happened again. So that's a very important part of the report worth highlighting. On the Chinese side, there are some structural problems, too. The best conversations between U.S. and Chinese officials, in my view, were when they were small. And that especially goes for the president with President Hu Jintao, or when Dr. Rice or Secretary Powell went to China. We always tried to arrange small one-on-one or two-on-two or three-on-three meetings, because for the Chinese president, that was the opportunity to be unscripted and frank. And the American president has more of an ability to do that, frankly, because he has more of a choice of who's in the room with him in these larger meetings. I highlight that because I think we need to work on opportunities for the two leaders to meet. When I was in the NSC, we wanted the Hu Jintao visit, the one in April that had various snafus that happened after I left the NSC. We really on our side wanted to do, I'll tell you, a Camp David or Crawford, 2 or 3 days, no neckties, roll up the sleeves, get down to business, not scripted. And I will tell you, there was a lot of resistance, not from our colleagues in the Chinese embassy, but others in Beijing, to sending President Hu into that kind of unscripted environment. I think we really have to keep pushing on the U.S. side to try to create those opportunities, get the protocol right, but not worry as much about the protocol and fanfare and try to create opportunities for really frank, long discussions. Typically, a summit meeting of an hour and a half with translation is, in fact, a discussion of 45 minutes. And once you go through all the required talking points, you have very little time for actual frank exchange on issues. So I think that's something that at the high level we need. And it's a structural problem, and it's a political culture issue that we have to get our Chinese friends to work on. Another problem, now that I'm in the academic sector, I see, is that resources are not available on the Chinese side. We can do lots of exchanges with Korea, Japan, and Australia because they have foundations, they have government funding. It's very hard to get Chinese scholars to conferences, to do joint projects. It's a resource issue. There are some good recommendations in the report, but we need to address it. We have the obvious structural problem that the Congress doesn't have a logical counterpart. The National People's Congress is who Senator Stevens works with. There's some huge differences I don't need to go into that make that difficult. We also have a bit of a problem in that our academic sectors are very different. There is a problem in political science in the United States and in economics as fields where regionalists are being pulled to do more and more generalizable theory. And to get tenure, I'm tenured at Georgetown, and it's kind of a miracle I got it, because in general, to be tenured in a university these days in political science or economics, American scholars are under enormous pressure to do generalizable theories. And there's a lot of pressure to produce that kind of work to get tenure. So for younger scholars coming up through the system in the U.S., there aren't enough opportunities for policy exchange with their Chinese counterparts. Ezra Vogel at Harvard has started a program to bring young, promising academics, recent PhDs in China studies, political science, economics, to Washington to learn how to do policy, to engage the think tank community. We need a lot more of that and a lot more of those opportunities, in my view. Last thing I would say, it's not in the report. The report focuses on policy communities, which includes the think tanks. I personally have a concern and had a concern since I was in the White House that we have some weaknesses in civil society exchange. The Chinese side has been quite forthcoming on issues like healthcare and economics and development. But when it comes to areas of civil society, women's empowerment, rule of law, labor, and these kinds of things, the trend, frankly, over the last 2 years has been for the Chinese government to create pressures on Chinese NGOs that make it difficult to have exchange. Now, some of this may be the U.S. side's fault because we've emphasized democracy building so much. But it is an area that in contrast to Korea, Japan, Australia, other Indonesia even, where there is not as much of a permissive environment for American NGOs to do civil society work in China. And it's not in the report, it's not the main focus, but it is important, I think, to the health of the relationship and to overall exchange between the U.S. and China. But on the whole, having, you know, worked on these issues, I think Bates has made an important, very important contribution. It points in exactly the right direction, and I hope my colleagues, my former colleagues, pay close attention to it.
Sorry.
Thank you. I don't know whether you happened to catch Tom Friedman's op-ed piece this morning in the New York Times, but he makes a point in today's context of the testing, if that's what it was, in North Korea, that the only chance to avoid a race to a nuclear-armed world, that's a slight overstatement, not much, is to get Russia and China really involved, fully engaged, to recognize they have all the risk that everybody else has. How would that be accomplished, do you think, particularly with respect to China?
Let's give that to Michael.
The six-party process was designed in part to pull China in. And the initial conversations that Secretary Powell had with the Chinese leadership in February 2003 about setting up such a structure were a bit rough because the Chinese side did not want to get pulled in because they had the foresight to know this would be an enormous headache for them. But in the end, the Chinese did agree to host the six-party talks and have been pulled into this process. And indeed, it has been an enormous headache for them. I think that 3 years of continual headache has informed Chinese thinking about North Korea in important ways because they've had to deal with it in a constant day-to-day way, not just the party, not just the PLA, but especially the foreign ministry and the leadership. And I think where the Chinese probably at one point, this is often said and I think it's true, put a higher emphasis on stability rather than denuclearization, the North Korean escalation I think has increasingly led to the conclusion that if China doesn't do more, they're going to end up with both, with a nuclearized Northeast Asia and instability because North Korea is overplaying its hand. And that's why the Chinese have, since the missile launches in July by North Korea, stepped up and agreed to pressure much more than pundits outside of CSIS or Georgetown expected because I think they see that they have a stake in this. And so I think the prognosis is pretty good for U.S.-China cooperation in dealing with this, and I think in Iran as well. It's never as much as we want, but I think that the Chinese side is stepping up increasingly because they realize the risk to China if they don't take some risk now to put more pressure. At the end of the day, the Chinese will not agree, I believe, to full sanctions on North Korea that would cause collapse of the regime. But I think they will cooperate with some pretty tough targeted sanctions. And that if the North Koreans keep escalating, U.S.-China expansion cooperation will expand. And Japan-China cooperation will expand, as you saw with Abe's visit. Japan-Korea. So the North Koreans have helped create the opportunities for this. The more it goes up to the leadership, the more it's as a day-to-day problem, it's handled by President Hu, the more the Chinese, I think, step up and look at this in a strategic context. And the North Koreans have made that now unavoidable.
Thanks very much, Mike. I think one of the important lessons we can draw from what we've seen over the past several years in terms of U.S.-China relations vis-a-vis North Korea is the importance that Washington has placed upon that relationship and sort of the high profile that it has given in a way that has, I think, granted to China or offered to China an opportunity to step up and take a more serious regional leadership role, something which maybe they were reluctant to do at first, but which I think over time they've come to accept is probably, all things considered, in their interest to do, but also reflective of what their aspirations probably are over the longer term, is to play a more important regional role. And to have the United States more or less accepting that, even encouraging it, I think has allowed for those anybody who is still dragging their feet in Beijing to gain confidence and to step forward and to take the measures that they have. I was very struck by the language that the Chinese used, for example, in response to the recent test, if that's what it was. But in any event, it was very strong, and I think, as you say, far stronger than most of us would have expected. At the end of the day, China still has very, very serious interests. They clearly want the outcome, whatever it might be, on the Korean Peninsula to be as closely aligned with what they see as their interests rather than necessarily those of the United States. I think the key going forward is to make sure that in our discussions with China and especially in our public expressions of what we expect from China, that we couch those as strongly as possible in terms of shared interest. And I think you can make a very convincing case that we increasingly do share, and that those dichotomies that we once talked about where, you know, proliferation was given a lower priority, that is changing. I agree with you on that, Mike. And to the degree we can continue to press that, I think we can hope for some success there.
I also think that there was a great debate after Bob Zoellick made his speech a year ago with respect to China, should be a stakeholder, that we should give deference to its views, but that with that deference comes, and respect to its views, but with that deference comes responsibility. And there was a great debate among the elite in China. In fact, there was no translation of the word. And I think that debate caused them to take more of a leadership role and a sharing role. But as this report points out, it's terribly important that we also understand their point of view. There is no easy answer. They do worry about Koreans pouring across their border. They do worry about instability at a time when they have a lot of challenges domestically themselves. And we should listen carefully to their concerns as we want them to listen carefully. And I think Mike's right that they are giving more credence to the nuclear worry than focusing entirely on stability. But we have to have our ears open as well as having them step to the center of the international stage.
I also agree with everything in this report. I think there's just one slight omission, and if you go to the heart of this, it's interaction between America and Chinese, both at the government level and at the business level. And it would be great to have a direct flight from Washington to Beijing and vice versa, especially for those living here. But it doesn't really help to save 2 hours if it takes you 5 months to get a visa. And the way the Chinese are treated today, you know, our State Department visa policy is 20 years out of date. The Chinese are presumed guilty. You know, billion-dollar CEOs have to wait 3 months and sit through a degrading interview trying to prove that they have enough assets and they're not going to escape to the U.S., which is, I think, just degrading. And they just simply don't want to come. And it's the same thing with Chinese government officials. Until that policy is renewed and sophisticated, a lot of this will be difficult to achieve.
That probably constitutes a comment rather than a question. And I saw a hand over here, Ernie.
Oops. Ernie Prieg, Manufacturers Alliance. One quick question, then a comment. The question is on the direct flight. Is the problem a matter of the governments and the airline agreement that has to be modified, or is it lack of interest by airlines? Or, you know, what has to be done, in other words? My comment is a little broader. Our deepest engagement in China on the ground, of course, is our business leadership, our companies. And not as many Americans as Europeans or Asians, but still a big number. And yet in the report, this is sort of an omission or a thought, on the action within the non-governmental policy community and your conclusions about explore and expand innovative U.S.-China partnerships, there's no real mention specifically of business leadership in the two countries. Now, in background, with between our business organizations, U.S., Europe, Japan, Canada, there's decades of interaction that push governments and are ahead of the curve. There's a whole structure in the OECD in trade negotiations, less in Doha because of agriculture, but certainly Uruguay around, Tokyo. Okay. There's a whole history of the business leaderships interacting. And one might say, of course, in China up until now, it's been mainly foreign companies that are out front. But Chinese multinationals are coming of age. And they're moving quickly. And I just wonder whether there wouldn't be, isn't this a time maybe where the business organizations should get linked up better and have the dialogue? There's a lot of mutual interests, certainly, not only bilateral, but multilaterally, mutual interests that might be more apparent to business leaders in China than to the government. There are also potential conflicts, and it's much better to talk about them. So I wonder whether this wouldn't be a good idea. It could even have a salutary political dimension in having a somewhat independent dialogue between the business leaderships, the Chinese and the foreign and the American business leaderships.
Thanks, Ray. That's an excellent suggestion. I appreciate that. I think part of the problem I had in this report was trying to somehow stay within a relatively good definition of what policy community means. That shouldn't at all preclude, though, your idea, because clearly we have major organizations in this town, like your own and the U.S.-China Business Council, the American Chamber, et cetera, who under which this kind of a more formalized business-to-business exchange could be instituted. I think it's a great idea, and maybe there are things ongoing. And former president of the U.S.-China Business Council, Bob Kapp, is here. He might be able to comment on whether that sort of activity is already going on. But I think it's a great idea. The question of the connection between Washington and Beijing. It's my understanding that from time to time our two countries negotiate expansion in the flights that would be going between the United States and China. And when those negotiations are agreed to at the government-to-government level, then it's up to the regulatory bodies in our country to determine which airline and from where that's going to take place. And that's a competition that is undertaken. And I don't know what the inside rules and regulations and procedures are all about this, but at the end of the day, a decision is taken by our regulatory bodies about which city that's going to be and which airline is going to be. So these are decisions that are taken within the regulatory processes of our country. Obviously...
Let me just say, 25 years in the State Department, it's one of the very, very few areas.
Okay.
Very strong leadership role, and particularly the China relationship, maybe the aviation
Well, actually, on the application, the issue is before the Department of Transportation. I believe that the negotiations have proceeded to the point that there will be a new U.S.-China route. The question for the Department of Transportation is, from what city? It isn't the airline that is selected. It's the city that is selected. Of course, incidentally, some airlines fly from some cities and other airlines fly from other cities. I think that the reason why this report mentions it is for the broad policy community to be able to get to Beijing with nonstop service would be a plus. If you look at page 36, figure 6, it shows that every major capital in the world has direct flights to Beijing, except that of the United States. And so for a nation of our size and import not to have a direct flight is and a detriment if you want to expand and improve interaction in the broad policy community. Furthermore, and you're picking conference sites, that is a factor. If you can fly from Beijing to London nonstop, or you want to have a conference in Washington but there's no direct flight, the likelihood is you might choose to go to Beijing to London. And so, again, the United States loses out. I was shocked by the statistics that we have so many fewer students in China studying. We have so many fewer visitors going to China than Europe. And if you take a long-term view of a half a dozen years, we will harvest the harm from that, in my opinion.
Just briefly on this business idea. By the way, I have a solution. The Transportation Department should do the Washington flight so they can then fly over and negotiate the next one more effectively. Seems, as a native Washingtonian, I have to say it seems only fair. We had a very, in the administration, intense concern about the Japanese economy in 2001, 2002, huge non-performing loans, deflation, and so forth. We established a bilateral interagency body called the Economic Partnership for Growth. It was like the Joint Committee on Commerce and Trade with China in many ways. And at that time, the administration, and I was part of this, decided to set up a business advisory group to work with this group. I'm not sure that Secretary Paulson has done that or that the JCCT has done that, but it is one. It was extremely effective because these business leaders would meet and make recommendations to the governments and to the leaders, which propelled the process faster than the governments could do on their own. This is U.S.-Japan, and there are some differences in how Japanese business leadership works compared to China. But it turned out to be very effective. The Japanese bureaucracy at first was rather panicked that their business leaders were making all these recommendations that were not scripted. And I think you'd find the same thing in China. And so it was very useful, and I think it's a good idea, and you could probably graft something like that to what the JCCT does or to what Secretary Paulson does. I don't think there's such a structure in place at present.
Was a former chairman of the U.S.-China Business Council to tell us how much does business collaborate with the policymakers, and could they do more?
You know, some years ago I asked my Chinese friends if it was time to try to do a business-to-business CEO level bilateral. It was 5 or 6 years ago, and I remember one of my best friends from the Chinese embassy saying it's just not time yet because the sociology isn't right. I mean, you don't want the Americans looking at their wristwatches and thinking, oh my God, why did I come all the way over here? And at the same time, the social dynamics between the two sides are so uncooked yet. The social skills are so uncooked that the possibility of really kind of missing each other badly was too great. But that was probably 7 or 8 years ago, and I would say that things are changing extremely rapidly in that regard. And that if I went back and asked the same person today what he thought, he might well, as would I, have a different view. I think that there are a number of forums. There's the whole commercial conferencing world of the summit on this and the summit on that, which brings lots of business people together, especially for the better meetings. And there's Davos and so forth. And I think American and Chinese business figures, both from the state-owned sector and the vibrant non-state sector of the Chinese economy, find that they have more in common, even linguistically, as the younger people with greater language facility, particularly on the Chinese side, come into positions of real economic power. So it won't be a perfect match, but it wasn't a perfect match with Japan either, I'm sure. And the whole point of Bates's paper, I think, is that this is an ongoing, hard, laborious process. We need the logistical supports to make it as unlaborious as we can, but it's going to be hard work no matter how many years we work at it, and it can't be ignored. So I would hope that there would be more on the business-to-business side, and if my friends at the U.S.-China Business Council haven't already leapt into the breach, who knows? Maybe somebody else should, or maybe they will. I don't know. I haven't talked to them. I would say one other thing since I have the mic, and that is that in the area of Yancey mentioned the visa issue and made a telling point by saying it's nice to save hours on the airplane, but if you can't get a visa, it doesn't do you a lot of good. I continued, and I think it was Mike who mentioned that over time it seemed that the DOD sometimes was not quite conceptually in the same place that other parts of the executive branch have been. I have to say that the pending Commerce Department regulations on export control regulations, which are being presented to the policy community here in Washington in some ways as a step forward and as a sort of a user-friendly body of trade facilitating measures, bear very close scrutiny in this regard. And on the question of whether you proceed from the idea that China is the kind of China that we're hearing discussed in this room today, for which all that air travel and all of those meetings is going to be a supportive framework of progress, or whether you proceed from the idea that China is becoming and has already become the established major challenge to American national interests over the next 25 years or longer, and that needs to be dealt with in that kind of perspective. That question still is approached from different points of view in different parts of our government, and in this case, it is Commerce which has export control regulations that I think bear very close scrutiny.
If China is indeed to be the greatest challenge over the next 25 years, doesn't it behoove us to have more understanding, more in-depth knowledge, and create bonds that work against hostility and toward trust?
Eric McVaden, the Institute of Foreign Policy Analysis. I was trying to think of some other factors that influence the relationship. And I was reminded that I sometimes hear from my Chinese colleagues, and it's probably not very representative, but complaints about our closer relationship with Japan, saying that we should balance that more or something. So I wonder if you're hearing that. A while back, I also heard suggestions that we might be more enthusiastic about a Northeast Asian security arrangement. But thinking of a positive factor, and I wonder if you share this particularly, Mike, contemplating the North Korean test issue, it seems to me that though that's a great disappointment for China and for us and so forth, that just might present us with some real opportunities under this stressful situation to really move forward with the relationship. So maybe I'm trying to find the bright side of that, but if I can find any encouragement, maybe it's in that form.
Of course, I was closely associated with building up the U.S.-Japan alliance, so my Chinese counterparts never asked me to stop. It may not be the best representative sample. I think the Chinese side realizes how important the U.S.-Japan alliance is to the United States now and how important it is to Japan and that there isn't much utility in trying to drive a huge wedge at this point. And I think the tone in the tone is changing very quickly. The strategic rivalry that's there under the surface is unlikely to go away soon. But Abe's trip, his agreement to set up a joint commission on history, a lot of, Abe has done a little bit of a Nixon goes to China from the right of Japanese politics to build a much better, set up a much better tone and begin chiseling away at some of the core problems. And so I think that will hopefully improve the Chinese view of our alliance with Japan and of Japan. And I agree with you. I think that the if nothing else, this North Korean nuclear test adds clarity. In our discussions, the Chinese and our ROK allies were almost never willing to say in official forums that North Korea has nuclear weapons, even though that was our assessment officially, unanimous intelligence, public intelligence community assessment. Privately, our Chinese and South Korean counterparts would acknowledge it, but they weren't really willing to say it publicly, which meant that we had very different assumptions in some ways as we were working this problem. We're now all on the same page in terms of what the reality is, and I think that that has made an enormous difference, aside from all the negative effects of this test. I think you're absolutely right. One positive effect is we're all now clearly seeing this in the same way, because there's no denying that they have this capability.
For one more question, is there one? Oh, please, would you approach a microphone? Thank you. They'd like you to speak into the microphone so that they can record the question.
Sure. I'm Nai Chen Mo from Phoenix Television of Hong Kong. I noticed the report didn't put too much emphasis on the Taiwan issue. My comment on that a little bit. I assume if you talk to any Chinese official, they probably would tell you the Taiwan issue is considered the most sensitive or crucial issue in the U.S.-China relationship. So I guess my question is, with the U.S. and China having more interdependent relationship, how do you see the status of the Taiwan issue? Do you think it will still remain at the center, or you will move to the periphery? Thank you.
I wouldn't expect that the Taiwan issue would in any way move out from its central place in U.S.-China relations, and that would happen anytime soon. I think what we have seen, though, is the ability of leaders in Beijing, in Washington, and in Taipei to recognize a little more clearly the interest that we all three share in avoiding problems and conflict, and that gaining time for all three sides to think through what the longer term implications of our relations will be is in everybody's interest. There's been some rough times in recent years in Washington-Taipei relations as well as in Taipei-Beijing relations, but by and large, I think we should be encouraged that the more visionary and statesmanlike thinking has fortunately come to the fore, and I think brought a degree of stability to the situation. And I think that is likely to continue. I mean, it's tough to make predictions on these sorts of things, but I think looking forward, we can be relatively confident that this sort of stability and statesmanlike management of this relationship is likely to continue, and that's something we should all be encouraged about.
Dave, if I get the last word, I would say that you hear around the table a tremendous appreciation for the effort you've made in this report. There seems to be a real consensus that expanding and improving the bilateral relationship should be top on our list, and therefore we should do those things that enable us to achieve high harmony. I thank you for what you've done. Would you like to... And I certainly thank those that have been at the table for your comments. I think you've enriched the report. Michael, you were terrific. It was wonderful to have you participate and bring your background from not only East Asia but the NSC to the table. And so with that, we thank you very, very much for joining us. And get out and sell the message of this report.